The American Herbalist Guild presents its 13th annual AHG Symposium, titled Comparative Medicine for Clinical Practice, held October 10th through 13th, 2002. The following presentation was recorded live at the George Williams Conference Center at Lake Geneva, Wisconsin.
Hello, I am Kevin Spalmer, and you're not. Ever heard of a cold immobilization test? That's the wrong lecture. No, seriously, ever heard of a random number generator? Let me tell you about a random number generator, because this has a profound impact on what we're about to do here clinically. And a random number generator is essentially a computer that generates a series of numbers. Okay, and you don't know what numbers are going to come up. So I think it was either Columbia or Princeton that basically took college students and put them in front of a random number generator and said, "Okay, we want to see if you can affect the outcome of the numbers that come up on the screen." And guess what happened? They found some that were quite good at it. And you know that beginner's luck thing where, you know, you start something, new skill, and you're really good at it initially, yeah. And then it fades because your feeble frontal cerebral cortex gets involved, right? Well, that's exactly what happened, right? First people were good at it, and then it would fade, and either it would come back or it wouldn't. But in fact, some people could actually, by intention, affect the series of numbers that were coming up on the screen. And then some of you heard me talk yesterday about the experiment where they take a petri dish of bacteria, they put it in a room, they put a college student in front of it, and they say, "Okay, we want to see if you can affect the growth of the bacteria. So let's see if you can impede the growth. Let's see if you can inhibit the growth of the bacteria." And guess what? There are some people that were really good at it. And then they took them and they said, "Okay, here's another petri dish of bacteria. We want to see if you can stimulate the growth." Some of them are really good at it. So what I'm getting around to saying here is that intention can drastically affect the outcome of what's going on. In the same sort of way, this is a quantum physics principle, essentially. The way you set up an experiment with an electron will determine what answer you get. So that whole thing about, is an electron a particle or a wave, right? Does it have mass and volume, or is it massless and just pure energy? Depends on the question you ask, and depends on the observer, therefore. Because who's asking the question? The observer. So in the lab, if you ask a particle question of an electron, you get a particle answer. And if you ask a wave question, you get a wave answer. So what I'm getting around to saying here is that observers today, you're going to affect things. And this is something I've been having interns, students, apprentices watch consults now since about 96. And initially, I really felt the effects. Because indeed, when you sit with a patient, you have formed a system. You have formed a new relationship with someone. And when somebody walks into that, and you all know this from you know, you're hanging out with a friend and a third party shows up, right? And you can feel sometimes that, oh, God, you know, it really changed things. Well, that's what I want you to be aware of today. That just by your intent, just by your observation, you're potentially affecting Deirdre's health. So, and I want to thank Deirdre for being so open to be able to actually sit here in front of a bunch of people. It's something I wouldn't do. I wouldn't sit here in front of a bunch of people and get a consult. So thank you, Deirdre. And we'll get started here in just a second. So in other words, what I'm going to ask you to do then is keep your minds as clear as possible and essentially just watch the process. And so what I'm going to attempt to do here, and I feel very split because I'd say 80% of what I do in the clinic is actually counseling. It's actually forming a system, forming rapport with the patient, and using that to as a skeletal structure for healing. And I don't think I've ever, well, actually, I think I have had more people observing, but it's really changes things. So as if, in fact, 80% of what I'm doing is counseling, then it's kind of hard to counsel in front of a crowd, because it drastically alters things. So what we're going to do then is somewhat superficial, and this isn't actually how I would practice. So in the attempts to serve Deirdre and the attempts to educate, I'm going to wind my way through this. So keep that in mind, that when you sit with somebody, what you're about to see, this is not what's really going on. Okay, that's a very special time when you sit down with somebody. And, you know, this has a dramatic impact. So first of all, what I'd like you to do is just really sit and have gratitude, literally, because, in fact, if what I just said is true, and in fact it is, then gratitude in itself, that vibration, that intention, can actually have a wonderful impact. So I'd actually like you to feel, if you have to find that somewhere in your heart, take a second and go inside, but come up with some gratitude, that vibrational rate, and project that to Deirdre. And if Deirdre, if you would come up, that'd be great. And let's give this brave young woman a chair here. So one of the first things I'm going to do clinically, in terms of actually building rapport, is I'm not going to sit down and I'm not going to say, "So Deirdre, what's the problem?" Right? It's a little bit. Anybody do body work in here? Okay. So what would happen if you started with an elbow on a body? Right, yeah, the whole system would retract. Okay, so the first thing you want to do is attempt to establish some rapport. And so we would say something like, "Hi, how's it going today?
Good.
I noticed that book you were reading in the waiting room," or something like this. "You know, how is it? I've heard about that." You know, so you're opening with conversation versus the 6-minute visit of, "All right, what's the problem? Thank you. Next." Okay, so we're building rapport. And normally I would have a 6-page intake form that I would be able to look through as well and help guide myself. And so a lot of the questions that you might think that you need to ask are actually in the intake form. And what I can tell you about the intake form as well is that one of the key pieces for the intake form is not for my information. It's for the patient to stop and go, "Oh yeah, what am I eating for a typical breakfast? What does a typical lunch look like for me? And what do I want help with today? What exactly is that?" So, you know, you go through 5-6 pages of detailed questions that take about half an hour, and I usually don't have patients do that in the clinic. I usually send it to them so that they can do it at home in the comfort of their own home. You've stopped them, and you've started a process. You've already started the healing process. Okay. And one of the questions that I actually came up with after about 5 years in practice, it's been about 13 years now that I've been doing clinical work. After about 5 years, I was getting frustrated with adherence. I don't like the word compliance because it means you're doing something to someone, right? You're going to do this, right? But you can adhere to a program. So after getting frustrated with some people's adherence, I have a question on my intake form that basically says, "What conditions would you like help with?" It gives some space. The next question is, and this is what I added after 5 years, "Are you willing to make modifications in your lifestyle to change these conditions?" In other words, let's check in here, guys. I'm not going to do something to you that's going to change your health. You're going to do something that's going to have an impact. And interestingly, after I put that question in, I have never gotten a no. I've gotten some maybes, which is great, because people are honest. "Well, I don't know, you're this weird guy. I expected you to like have a ring out coming out of your nose, and you look kind of normal, but I'm not real sure about whether I'm really going to listen to you or not. Because I'm here because my doctor sent me, for example. I used to actually get a lot of referrals from docs. Or I'm here because I heard my neighbor said, you know, that you were going to help me. Or the great thing is guys. You know, they're. I don't know how your healthcare practices are. How many of you actually practice in here? Okay, so how many of you see almost exclusively women and very few men? Yeah. So the wife or the girlfriend sends in the guy, right? And I ask these guys, so why are you here? And they say, well, you know, because my wife wanted me to come. Now, here's a strategy there. I say, well, look, you're here for the wrong reason. And if, you know, I'm happy to work with you, but you need to be here because you want to be here. So it might be a good idea if we just gave you some time to think about this. And what have you just done? You've just given them choice, right? Yeah, exactly, responsibility. So I've never had anybody go, yeah, you're right, bye, I'm out of here. They go, well, the other reason I'm here is because I am kind of curious and I've been dealing with this, you know, health problem and, you know, maybe you can help me. The energy has just shifted in the room. Okay? In the patient's body, if we will, if I can draw on yesterday's lecture, anybody in from yesterday's lecture? Okay. In the patient's body, what you've just done is shifted the tone of the system. You've just shifted the informational flow of the system. So there's basically three main areas that I like to focus on with a patient, or I guess we're supposed to call them clients because we practice medicine without... No, I don't practice medicine. That's right. We don't practice medicine without license. We give health suggestions. That's it. There's three main areas that I like to focus on with the patient besides... the chief complaint, okay? And that is the gut. In fact, we'll see if my writing hand works here. Okay, so I want to know all about the gut. And why do I want to know that? A couple of reasons. Number one, two-thirds of your immune system is clustered in your gut. Two-thirds of your lymph tissue is clustered in your gut. Okay, why do you think that is? Think about it. I mean, nature always has a reason. That's right. There's no other part of your body that comes in touch with the outside world as much as your gut. And cell-to-cell communication is set up, for the most part, on peptides. And the food that you ingest, for the most part, its structure of a lot of it, well, cellulose, and peptides, proteins. So if you've got peptides leaking in to the bloodstream, what you're going to get into is a situation where you've got schizophrenia of cell-to-cell communication. You've got foreign messages going in, right? And so it makes sense that the immune system is paranoid of foreign peptides. So the gut is one thing you want to think about because of that. Also, you've got direct access to central nervous system via the gut. You've got 9 times as many messages going up from the gut to the brain as from the brain to the gut. There's actually a nervous system in the gut, 100 million neurons, called the second brain, that can profoundly impact your central nervous system. In fact, it looks like it's giving the orders. 9 times as many messages going from the enteric nervous system to the CNS as the CNS going to the gut. So that's one of the reasons I like to focus there. And I promise you, we will get there. The other area that I really like to look at, and I consider a checkpoint to check the status of the central nervous system, is sleep. So what kind of sleep is somebody having? Can they actually go down? If the central nervous system's tone is too high, is too frenetic, it's very difficult for people to rest. Okay, we all have this basal tone to our central nervous system. And if in fact it's a little bit too tense, or a little, think of it on a piano, too high of a note, you're not going to be able to you're not going to be able to rest very well. And the last thing I like to look at is what I call sosh, which looks like sock when I write it on my sheet, but is sosh, sociology. And this tells me something about, in this case, Deirdre, and how she's communicating with her environment. So those are the key things. Now, obviously, you're going to look also at past medical history. You're going to look at chief complaint, as we mentioned. You're going to look at any aberrant processes that they're aware of that go on in their body. But what you're going to find, and you're going to, you know, you can't say with the gut, you can't say, Deirdre, how's your digestion? In this case, she might say, well, not so good. But a lot of people, you know what they'll say? Fine. What's that? They don't have anything to compare it to, right? Unless there's a recent change. So, let's, actually, I had a few minutes with Deirdre before we started, so I don't want to fool you. I know a few things here. But in terms of chief complaint, you basically said there wasn't any, or? Ah, yeah, so
well,
we're going to get really cozy here.
when I get agitated and nervous, and I moved recently to a new place, you're looking for a job, you know, it goes to my digestive system and my sleep has been affected.
Which, of course, tells us immediately. So what I think when I hear that is I'm going, okay, we've got not only the enteric nervous system affected potentially, okay? Because what's happened? What I've just heard is stress. Did you say you just moved to a new job, or you just moved as well, or both?
New place, still looking. I have a bunch
of questions. Okay. So, what's on the stress scale? Moving?
High.
Extraordinarily high, right? Equivalent to a death of someone close. So that's a huge stress. And if you think about what's happened, I want you to think about it in terms of us being a cell. Because indeed, if the Gaia hypothesis is true, if in fact the Earth is a living organism, or at least acts like a living organism, then every one of us is some sort of a cell. And I like the old phrase that the herbalist or the immune system of the planet. If you take a cell out of the body, or even a tissue out of the body, and you move it somewhere, what do we call that? Or tissue and move it,
surgery,
right, which is an incredible stress, and a transplant.
Transplant.
Right? So we've transplanted a cell. Now, you know that in the medical system, a transplant's a huge deal. And in terms of a broader model of life, the human society as being a social organism, Deirdre's been transplanted. Right? So no surprise that in somebody of this frame, and when I say this frame, if you look at her morphology, what you're really going to see here is thinness, right? An ectomorphic structure. Is everybody good with that when I say ectomorphic? Okay. No. Okay. So ectomorphic essentially means small bones, very little body fat. And the ectoderm of the central, the ectoderm of an embryo gives us what tissue? The nervous system. Oh, wait a minute, huh? Something's starting to make sense here. And in Ayurveda, in terms of Vata, Vata has an affinity for the nervous system. It's rather amazing. If you look at Sheldon's work, William Sheldon, ectomorph, mesomorph, endomorph, and look at Ayurveda, they closely match each other. So Deirdre, just by looking at her frame, we can say, it's very likely that she has a very sensitive central nervous system. And indeed, that's the kind of complaint we're seeing in terms of sleep. And indeed, in terms of the enteric nervous system, it's still a nervous system. Very likely this is part of what's going on for her. So what I'm going to say is, okay, so what's your appetite like? Let's give you a scale of weak, moderate, strong. Where would you put your appetite? Great information, right?
Changeable.
Changeable, variable, right? And so what does that tell you in an Ayurvedic model? At least she's got a vata derangement, if not truly vata. But we already know the frame. Yeah, we're looking at, okay, there's vata. Is this your natural hair color?
It's brown, red.
Okay. So, and we also know that there's something else going on here besides just vata. Look at the skin and the freckles, right? And look at the color of the hair. This is not just pure vata. But in any event, at this point, let's think about vata. Variable appetite. The wonderful thing about vata is that if you don't like it, you just wait 5 minutes and it will change. You know, it's like the weather in some places, and it's so true. That vata mood, the vata ability to metabolize, all that is very changeable. So that makes perfect sense here. Deirdre, in terms of food cravings, anything that you're particularly attracted to, any foods you walk by and they whisper your name? Mm-hmm. Any flavors as well?
Weather change, more warm, nourishing. I've had my morning job is teaching English to Mexican immigrants, and I've been bringing tamales and hot chocolate, and it's been really, I normally don't eat this.
It feels good.
It feels good, yeah.
Okay. Where were you moving from?
San Francisco.
Okay. And you just moved to?
Chicago.
Ooh. Okay. Yeah, let's keep you pumped up on tamales and hot chocolate, yeah. The reason I say that, I'm being facetious somewhat, because we don't want somebody eating a ton of sucrose in the hot chocolate, but warming foods, building foods, right? That's the idea here. Are you a meat eater?
No, but my boyfriend eats meat, so I've been eating more lately. Sometimes I eat meat.
And we're going to encourage your boyfriend to have strong influence in that area on you. And the reason I say that, in terms of this constitution, okay, you don't see a lot of storage ability in this constitution, do you, in terms of the body? Now, that's a metaphor, because for vata, you don't have a lot of storage ability in terms of the mind. Okay, so in other words, to be consistent, to hold something, is not easy for a vata, whether it's mind or body, which is why we see variability in this constitution. So if we can put more fat and protein, although the media makes us think, oh my God, fat, right? If we can put more fat and protein into the system is going to feel better. So a lot of us think that we're being vegetarians for our health. And I would say to you that this is potentially an erroneous idea. If you're vegetarian for spiritual reasons, I respect that deeply, and I believe in that. But if you're a vata constitution and you're a vegetarian for the reason that you're trying to improve your health, you might be missing the boat. Okay?
Yeah, because I can put on weight, though. I mean, I don't consider myself a skinny vata.
Yeah.
So how does that fit in?
Well, in any constitution, in any system, in any human, you're not just going to be purely vata or purely pitta or purely kapha. You absolutely have to have all three influences to have life. Okay? So for vata, you have to have movement of some sort. For pitta, it brings in metabolism to the system. And kapha brings in stability. The more kapha you have, the more easy it is to stabilize yourself. The more kapha you have, the easier it is to gain weight. And literally, you hear kapha say, I look at food and I gain weight. And that's just about true. Okay. One second. Yeah.
I was just going to say, I'm sort of here because I don't really know what those terms exactly mean.
Yeah.
I don't know if this is the right term or at later.
You know, I'm thinking it's probably not, because if we go into that, we're never going to serve Deirdre here. Yeah.
One thing I think of about pitta is that it's easy to gain weight and easy to lose weight. A lot of hard to gain pitta, easy to gain to lose, and half a hard to lose.
Hard to lose. Yeah, I think that is true. The comment for the tape is vata loses weight easily, pitta loses and gains easily, kapha loses very difficultly. And so I'd say this is true too. Part of what we're seeing here, as we hinted at the freckles and the reddish hair, this is fire. in the system. And so Deirdre is by no means just Vata, but looking as cold as she is right now, you might think that. So cravings, we see a little bit of sweet, but it doesn't sound like it's dramatic, which is good. And part of this, too, oftentimes is discipline. One of the things you'll see with Vata constitution is that they crave sweets oftentimes to ground themselves, and then they get into this habit of craving sweets to stimulate themselves. Because if they're going for sucrose sweets, that's why you always ask, what's the perfect sweet for you? If you're craving sweets, what's the perfect sweet? Some people will say, a glass of milk. Well, you know something very different is going on there than if somebody says, yeah, Snickers bar, or, chocolate cake with chocolate icing, right? Very, very different things. And oftentimes, when people are craving sweets, what they're really craving is fats. And so that's why if you ask this question, and it's a useful question, what flavors foods do you crave? And they say sweets, which ones? Because you want to distinguish, are they actually craving fats or actually sucrose? And one of the symptoms of essential fatty acid deficiency is that you're actually craving fat. Or sweets, but you're going for fat foods. So cravings. So no particular strong cravings for you?
No, but when you were saying that, I just thought what I always get when I want something sweet is this raisin bran. That's a healthy bran, you know, whole bran with the raisins and that with milk, and that to me is very satisfying.
Okay. Okay, so that sounds like a pretty healthy. That sounds like a yogic teacher's cravings for sweets. So that sounds fairly good. Now the other thing in terms of gut that I want to know is I'm going to say digestion. And what I mean by that, and the way I usually ask this question is, Deirdre, from the time you put something in your mouth to the time you poop, okay, and that's a clinical word, poop, right? And actually, seriously, people seem to be more comfortable with that than feces or, you know, obviously you're not going to say, well, never mind, the other S word. But from the time you put something in your mouth to the time you poop, any gastric distress at all, any pain, any bloating, any gas, any belching?
Yeah, the hardest thing has been my boyfriend eats very fast, like literally, and I'm talking, and it's gone. The plate's empty, and I'm just, you know. And so I feel compelled to eat faster
to keep
than
up
I normally
with him.
Have.
Yeah.
And that, more than anything else, is, then I'll get gas and indigestion, and some burpy, and a little burpy, you know. But it's from the speed. And maybe talking and too much air.
So my suggestion is, just before you guys sit down to eat, sit in his lap. Stroke him a little bit, kiss his neck, get him to relax a little bit. And that'll help that. You like that idea?
I know, so I was like, I missed the whole meal.
Okay, we're having very colorful, for the tape, we're having very colorful suggestions here about what can be done here with this. So let's reiterate that. So what we heard was you're eating fast and you get bloated or you get gas or you're belchy or...
I feel slightly out of breath and I feel like I'm gas, I guess, and just a feeling of like, oh, this isn't a little bit of... Like I haven't, a little nausea maybe, it's just slight, but that I haven't, it just was too fast and now it's not absorbing and digesting. I haven't been chewing the food enough.
Okay, so you get the sense of nausea, it's subtle.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'd say more just that heavy and gassy feeling.
Okay. Any pain at all?
No, just discomfort.
Discomfort, okay. And then, of course, the other question, and this is... potentially very difficult for some people. And I just moved from 15 months ago from New Mexico to Baltimore, so I'm in a different culture now. And in New Mexico, you ask people about their poop, and they're, oh, yeah, well, let me tell you what it looks like, you know, right? And in Baltimore, people tighten up a bit. You can see, yes, well, my stool's fine. Yeah, thank you. Yes. Could we go on to the next question, please? But you always want to ask people about bowel movements, because this is a huge issue. And, you know, my patients that in New Mexico before I sold my practice that were had been seeing for a long time, they would come in and, because they know my slant on this, they'd come in and they'd say, boy, you're going to love this, Kevin. You should hear what my doctor thinks about how many times a week I should have a bowel movement. My doctor tells me that if I have a bowel movement 2 times a week, I'm fine. Right? It is true.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, essentially, this is a belief. Right. But we have to step back and think about reabsorption, right, and endotoxins and this sort of thing. So, and in fact, World War II-ish time in the 40s, commonly what you saw was a diagnosis of intestinal toxemia by physicians. That went away. We've lost some of the subtleties of mainstream, well, we lost quite a few of the subtleties of mainstream medicine with the advent of the reliance on drugs. The physician didn't have to be so aware of subtleties. But you look at this class of, and yesterday I said, okay, we're going to talk about the Jeff Bland School of Functional Medicine, put it in a cyst, put it over the side, and we're going to talk about functional disorders. Well, today we're going to take that cyst out. We're going to talk about functional medicine. There's a lot of physicians now, this class of functional medicine, that are really looking at subtleties again, starting to practice more like you or I might practice. And I really embrace it. It's wonderful to see. And it's interesting because the reason they're practicing that way is because of the science. Okay, so the science is there to support this. It's just it hasn't made it into mainstream yet. So long-winded explanation. Deirdre, how are your bowels? Yeah.
I'm in California.
Good.
Okay, light color, a little on the lighter side.
Okay.
Very healthy size.
Okay. How often do you move your bowels?
Once a day.
Okay, one time a day.
And if I'm haven't slept well, it's delayed. Normally in the morning, but if I'm agitated, long later in the day, or if I've traveled in a car or something, then.
Do you skip days at all?
If only with travel or some major sort of stress, but yeah, that occasionally happens.
And occasional is how often?
If I take a trip, stress related, maybe once a month will happen.
Okay, yeah. So that's pretty acceptable. But what you're hearing also, what I'm hearing, is a bowel reactivity. Okay, when I get stressed. Okay, I tend to clamp down. And this is really, really common. In fact, you'll have patients that the reason they're constipated is because they're just tight. Okay, their musculature is just tight. It's a metaphor for the rest of them. You know the old expression, AR? What's AR stand for? Somebody else say it so they don't put it on the thing. In a sense, it's very true. I know these patients, and they will. They'll tend to clamp down and hold. They're holding on, and it goes through every level of their life. So we're not hearing that here. Yeah.
If I drink coffee, it'll almost immediately I'll have a bowel movement. If it's later in the day or hotter in the day, it'll be runny or even diarrhea. That's coffee. I have to be careful with.
Okay. Bowel reactivity. Okay, so that's what we're hearing is bowel reactivity here.
You're hearing bowel reactivity, and you're hearing that's different than tension?
No. What I'm saying is there's people that have a little bit of tension,
yeah,
and have a strong bowel reaction. Deirdre's got a little bit of tension and has a little bit of a bowel reaction, but I'm hearing the theme of bowel reactivity. And you don't necessarily see this in everybody.
But when you say the word reactivity, are you saying reacting to stress, or reacting to food, or reacting to anything?
Yes. Yeah, reacting to anything.
Okay.
Okay. And again, come back to the concept of the enteric nervous system, 100 million neurons. Okay. And I think what we're going to find, now this is completely speculative, but I think what we're going to find is that the ENS, the enteric nervous system, actually innervates more than the intestines, large and small. I think what we're going to find is that there's actually innervation to reproductive tissue, to the bladder. Okay? And already we're finding innervation to the pancreas via the enteric nervous system. So, you know, the enteric nervous system has been known about since Langley. I think it's 1921. Langley published a book, something by the term of, I think it was the autonomic nervous system, physician. And the original autonomic nervous system had how many branches? Right, you know what I'm talking about, autonomic nervous system? Okay, so what do you know about it? Yeah, so enteric nervous system is sympathetic and parasympathetic, but the original work, there were three branches. And those three branches were the parasympathetic, the sympathetic, and the enteric nervous system. And quick story, Langley wasn't liked very much. He had a journal. I'm trying to remember what the name of his journal was. I'm not sure what his journal was, but he had a journal. And as an editor, they hated him because he edited people's work without asking them. He would literally change concepts. And it seems as if Langley's work got edited. They cut out the enteric nervous system as part of the part of the autonomic nervous system. So originally, that's what the autonomic nervous system looked like. So it was a big deal, and it was recognized as that, and we've lost that concept. So what I'm saying here is that the enteric nervous system tends to be fairly sensitive, just like the central nervous system in Deirdre sounds like it's sensitive. Okay? The ectoderm gives you both the central nervous system and the enteric nervous system. So it's, in a sense, you can think of it as the same web. In fact, it is the same web. Yeah?
Just to help me understand your question again about bowel reactivity.
Yeah.
What would not having bowel reactivity look like?
What would not having bowel reactivity look like? That's a really good question. And you've seen these people. Oh, I can eat anything, doesn't bother me. I travel, my bowels are perfect. I just got a divorce, and my bowels are fine. In fact, they're better. Right.
I woke up with a traveler's constipation formula in my mind because my kidneys kind of have problems. So I created this whole formula in my mind. One had to do with tension, one had to do with like the gut stuff, and the other just the natural quinine.
Naturally, the comment was that Kathy woke up with a bowel formula in her mind, and perhaps in her bowel as well. Who knows? A traveling bowel. Okay, so let's move on to sleep. Now we can ask the question, "How's your sleep?" And that's a great open-ended way to start. Deirdre, how's your sleep?
I'm fitful. I'm thinking about, what job am I going to have? That whole anxiety around forming a new life, I think. So once my mind goes, I'm sitting there staring at the ceiling. Sometimes it's fine because I've worked all day and I can tire myself out trying to sleep. But.
Okay, so what we're hearing is that it's her nervous system that's keeping, well, actually it's her mind via her nervous system that's keeping her awake. You can also have a physical agitation in terms of trying to sleep. Okay, and that's not what I'm hearing here. I'm hearing more on a mental level that it's difficult to sleep. So some of the specifics I'm going to want to know is I'm going to say, Deirdre, what time do you usually go to bed?
Changing, because I have these different jobs, but I guess midnight.
Okay, so we go to bed around midnight. How long does it take you to fall asleep?
I've been getting up at 5:30, so if I go to bed at midnight, right away. But if I go to bed earlier, then maybe an hour.
So. Okay, so you're pretty used to going to bed at a later hour, so what I heard is if you go to bed earlier, you're still not going to fall asleep.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's say you go to bed at 11, mm-hmm. and you're laying there. What's going on? Okay, so your mind is active. Okay, and that's good information. So bedtime, how many times do you wake up during the night?
I usually can sleep through the night.
Okay.
Do you have just tossing and turning, or actually get up and?
No, just tossing and turning.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Maybe twice.
Okay. So you wake twice during the night, and do you are you able to fall right back to sleep?
Sometimes, sometimes not. It's very changeable.
Okay.
Again.
Right. So it's very changeable. So sometimes you're able to fall back to sleep and sometimes you're not. When you're not able to fall back to sleep, how long are you awake?
Not very long.
Not very long is?
Well, if it's the middle of the night, it's maybe 20 minutes, half an hour. That's a long time.
Okay, so 20 minutes to half an hour. And do you have to urinate at night? Do you have to get up to urinate?
If I can't sleep, yeah, that'll wake me up.
Okay.
Because sometimes I sleep fine, but I want it, but maybe twice a week I'll have trouble sleeping,
okay.
And then I'll wake up and have to pee, and then I'll be up for a while.
Okay, so 2 times a week it's difficult to sleep through the night.
Mm-hmm.
And the nights you sleep through, mm-hmm. do you have to wake up to urinate those nights?
No, usually in the morning. I can wait till the morning.
Okay, and what time do you wake up generally?
About 6:30, 7.
Okay, so 6:30 to 7. What time do you like to sleep till?
It's been so different because I used to be a late night person, but now I'd like to be able to sleep till 9.
Okay. Okay. How do you feel when you wake up at 6:37?
I feel sleepy.
You're fatigued?
Yeah.
Or is it sleepy or fatigue?
Is the difference mental? Or?
Well, the difference is physical. So you can wake up sleepy because you're slow.
Dragging, yeah.
But you can also wake up like, oh my God, I feel like I just went to sleep.
Yeah.
I'm not rested.
Right. Not that extreme, but it's...
It's a little bit of fatigue. Yeah. Okay. So let's actually go through these questions. So does she sleep through? In other words, what's going on is how what's the tone of the central nervous system like? And people that have a higher strung tone very often have a difficult time sleeping through the night. The question about nocturia or nocturnal urination, and this is something that I use. Now, there's a number of different reasons for nocturnal urination, obviously. Male, female, menopause, older age, male, female. But in younger people, very frequently, it's a measure of how much adrenaline they're running on during the day. So, yeah. Yeah. So, and in fact, what you'll also see, even sometimes during the day, is that they tend to urinate frequently during the day. Okay. So, the more you're running on adrenaline, the more frequently you're going to use the restroom because of the changes in kidney balance, water balance.
I understood this to be, and so I'm asking this one to say, is there a connection?
Yeah.
To be more of a, like, how are the kidneys holding and letting go of water? You know, how's the kidney functioning as far as how often they're peeing? Is it a chicken and egg thing? Is it an unassociated?
No, that's
Yeah,
very good. There's a hormonal connection between how much water the kidneys are, or actually how much sodium the kidneys are dumping versus how much sodium they're holding on to. Water follows sodium. Okay. So, and this is why you ask is if you're running adrenaline, you're dumping more sodium, which means you're dumping more water. You're urinating more frequently. And so this is why I asked that question.
But it also could be that the kidneys have an imbalance.
Yeah, it could also be, if we look at it in a Chinese model, we could just call it kidney deficiency. Yeah, absolutely. Yes? Right, which is a key question. So if I heard nocturia every night or 2 times a night, I'm going to ask, you know, how much fluid are you taking during the day? Yeah, yeah.
Just for what you're saying about kidney deficiency, the Chinese thing, if you consider the endocrine system,
Okay, and then waking up in the morning. I think one of the single most important diagnostic questions. How do you feel when you wake up in the morning? Right? Oh my God, I'm exhausted. I don't want to get out of bed. Right? Well, what's going on? Do you hate your life? Or are you running too hard on your life? Okay. And again, this thing you're going to see, if the tone of the central nervous system is such that you can't relax because the tone is too high, then you're going to see people that wake up exhausted. And those are people that are potentially setting themselves up for things like chronic fatigue syndrome because they never rest. And as a result, if you'll allow me the liberty, cell-to-cell communication is drastically shifted. Now, you can talk about immune function being shifted. I'm talking about all of it, okay? Not just endocrine, not just immune, not just central nervous system. The whole colony changes due to this. If you can't rest, and think about what rest really is. I mean, the whole thing about dreaming. What are you doing when you dream? Allow that to happen. If you can't get into that state where you can download the day, it's like stuffing your mouth full of food all day long. You're not going to be able to digest it. You're going to get sick. Allow that to happen. If you can't get into that state where you can download the day, it's like stuffing your mouth full of food all day long. You're not going to be able to digest it. You're going to get sick. The same sort of way, if you can't create some digestion time for your system, for your mental system, you're going to get sick. Okay. So it's a key point. Do you remember your dreams?
Yeah, often.
And do you have any reoccurring
themes?
Yeah, themes?
I used to, definitely. I haven't in a while related to my mother's death, but... Lately, but they're in stress dreams, sort of, you know. But they're not, lately they haven't been. I just, the feeling of anxiety in the dream.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And so we're going to leave that alone here. But in another setting, we'd probably follow that out a bit, which would take us to a whole different level. Right. Okay, so what are we seeing so far? We're seeing a gut that's somewhat reactive. Okay? We're seeing a central nervous system that's easily disturbed. Okay? Twice a week's a lot of time. Think about that. What's 2 out of 7? Somebody do the math for me. Yeah, I think it's a little more. Isn't it 35%?
A little more.
Is that right?
A little less.
A little less? Thank you. Okay. Qualitative is my strength, not quantitative. 2 semesters of calculus, and I started my third, and I was done. I had enough. Okay, so Sosh, 3 key questions here. Now, obviously, you can get into a lot, and in another setting, I would get into a lot more here. But 3 key questions that I like to ask. And number one is Deirdre, do you feel emotionally supported in your life?
Yeah.
Okay. And who is your support system?
My main support system?
Yeah.
Is my boyfriend.
Okay. Anybody else?
And my sister.
Boyfriend and sister. Okay. How often do you have contact with your sister?
She lives in California, so on the phone maybe twice a week.
Twice a week?
Yeah, email one.
So you just moved away from her?
Yeah.
You guys saw each other frequently when you were...
Yeah, we're right there.
Yeah. Is it hard to leave her?
Yeah.
How about your folks?
My mom passed away when I was 17. My father's in California.
Your father's there?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm sorry.
No.
You told me about your mother. Okay, so I'm getting a little uncomfortable here, but one of the things I'm going to say here is that her emotional support network is pretty small. And that worries me. And in fact, if you look, it's interesting because, you know, we're really primates, aren't we? If you look at primate models, the primates that get along best with the tribe, age the best. In other words, there is protective effect against stress from community. And being a male, you know, I remember my mother when I was young always telling me, Kevin, you can't be an island. Right? I'm like, yeah, watch me. Well, in fact, as I'm aging, I'm realizing, mainly because I'm a nerd and because of the research, because I got that male attitude. Yeah, well, we'll let women talk to each other, and us men, we'll just kind of check each other out and make sure we're not a threat to each other. but there really is a protective effect from having community. And so that's one of my concerns here.
Yeah, that's something I really want. I'm aware of that.
I'd like to see, yeah. Yeah, and you just moved.
Yeah.
And so this is one of the major stressors of moving, guys. I mean, you've just transplanted tissue from one body to another body. And what happens in a typical transplant system? Rejection,
yeah.
Right. Right. So, in other words, taking drugs to prevent it, you've got to modify something to prevent it, in essence. And depending on where you go, communities can be really open or really closed. And I don't know what Chicago's like, but I really want to encourage you in terms of your health, in terms of your long-term health, and literally think about what social support does. It creates a cradle. It holds you. Okay? This is one of the things I'm feeling in Baltimore. You know, 15 months in Baltimore, I don't have any social support, and I feel it. It's really difficult. All I do is work, right? So, like, it's not like I'm out there trying to make friends, because I'm, you know, I'm busy enough trying to create this whole new process of a master's program with my peers. But social support is essential. It's absolutely essential. It's a cradle. It supports you. It holds you. And so this is something that tips me off is, okay, if we have a disease condition, and I hear this, okay, I just moved. Well, I got two people in my life. That worries me. Because if it was a frank disease condition, I would bet, you know what? This has got strong potential for getting worse. Okay. The other question I'm going to ask is, so you've got this new job. And did you say you're tutoring?
Yeah, in the morning. I'm teaching yoga in the afternoon, massage.
Okay, so you're doing yoga, massage, and this tutoring job.
And freelancing, writing, and
oh my God.
And whatever I can get for money.
Okay, so you're all over the place.
Yeah.
Which one of those jobs do you enjoy the most?
I love teaching yoga. I like to bring it to different communities. And I love teaching Mexican immigrants in the morning, but it's very little pay.
The Mexican immigrants or the yoga?
Both, actually.
Okay, so they're both low-paying.
Yeah. But this job is to be an art director at a literary guild venue, which is what I love. I'm a writer, so. But it would anchor me more. My boyfriend's thinking of moving overseas, and anyway, there's just all these things that I'm not sure how they're going to fall into place. So a lot of, you know, what's the future going to hold kind of anxiety.
Right. So, when will your boyfriend may move overseas? When is this potentially going to happen? If it happens,
it's unclear. That's what. But it would be a dual life living in Chicago and having work over in Brazil.
So you would be doing. You'd be going
no,
back
he
and.
Would.
Okay, he would be
and
going back and forth.
He wants me to bring into it, but yeah.
Yeah. So, right, so we're not sure what's happening. The system's already reactive, right? Or, excuse me, you're already reactive, right? So you see where this is going to go, and the support system's small, and we're potentially losing half of the support system.
The half that's close.
Right, the half that's the closest, right. Okay, so normally that doesn't say jab, that says job.
Life satisfaction. What's the second word?
Satisfaction. So normally, if you're a pitta or a kapha, you usually just have one or two jobs. Vatas frequently have, you know, many things they piece together. And normally I would ask, I'd say, Deirdre, on a scale of 1 to 10, 10 being fantastic, 1 being, oh my God, I don't want to get out of bed and go to work, what's your job satisfaction like? But we've got so many jobs here, this is a difficult question. So I might say, which job do you enjoy the most?
Well, this job that I've made it through the first two interviews, and I'm between me and two, that's the job I want.
Okay.
But, it anchors me more to Chicago now, so.
Right, right.
It has a pros and cons.
So we know that you love teaching yoga and you're enjoying working with the Mexican immigrants, and that's not paying very well.
Yeah, and the art director position would be right up my
alley. Would be paying better.
Yeah.
You could, a livable wage.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, okay. So, and we don't know what that job satisfaction is really going to be like until you're there.
But you can hear her excitement.
Yeah, you can absolutely hear the excitement. But I'm cautious about that too.
Yeah.
Because I mean, I've seen this happen, 6 months, 12 months later, somebody's going, oh man, well, I thought it was going to be great. And indeed, I don't want to plant that seed. This, you're very artistic. You're Vata, for crying out loud. You're going to be artistic, right? So it's probably a really good place for you. How about life satisfaction? If I asked you again on a scale of 1 to 10, just looking at your life right now, what number would you give it? How would you rate your life satisfaction?
I'm where I want to be. I have trouble with numbers too. That number question. But I would like more resolution, a little bit more anchored roots. I've spent a lot of time wandering in my life, and the last 10 years, I've home a little bit of roots. I'm sort of obsessed on that now.
So
more than I've ever been. I never thought I would be. But.
You're craving community.
Yeah.
Is that what I'm hearing?
Yeah. Home, all those things I haven't had.
Right. Okay.
Molly's not that good.
Right, and meaning,
yeah.
in people's lives, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So then this thing with your boyfriend potentially leaving is really a big deal. Because
mm-hmm.
it could cause further unrest, further movement in your life, at least in your mind and your heart. Okay. Yeah, my point, exactly. We're disrupting stability here. The thing you're craving. Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Would you ask relationship satisfaction, or would you kind of weave that into life and then go there?
It depends on the rapport. And here I'm not going to do that. Boyfriend's sitting here, right?
Oh.
But on a first session on the East Coast, I'm finding I don't. In New Mexico, usually, yeah. So, and this is part of what you're keeping in mind here too, is if you're an herbalist and you're doing one session every couple of months with the same patient, you're missing the boat. Because what you're doing is you're teaching people. What you're doing is you're increasing people's awareness. And what you're doing is using your face and your rapport and the meaning of your relationship to remind them that they're on a healing journey. Okay, so follow-up is really, really key. I remember when I started practicing, one of my main concerns was the money. Right? It's like, and when I started practicing, I was charging $35 for an initial consult. And this was in 1952.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, no, so it wasn't 52. It was 89. And I was so concerned about the money that I would try to space the consults out between 4 and 6 weeks out, right? Something happened. I went and I did a rotation with an Ayurvedic physician who will remain unnamed, an actual Ayurvedic physician from India. And he was seeing people once a week. And I went, okay, there's more than healthcare going on here. My heart's in the right place. And this guy is actually getting good results, but he's probably taking advantage a little bit. So I think it's okay for me to ask to see people more often. And that's what shifted my thinking. And then you start thinking about how much people spend on beer in a month, or cigarettes, right? Or entertainment in general, and you go, okay, what I have is a value. And the biggest piece as a practitioner that you got to get over is your own self-esteem issue. Okay? Is my service of value? Right? And now, I'm going to tell you something honestly that I've seen happen. The more I charge, the better results I get. It is true. People value things. Don't get me wrong, I give a lot of consults away. Okay, in a typical day, I may give away a fifth of my time, which frankly is a fair amount of time. It's 20%. Yeah. What is the Well, and that's a great question. The question is, do I get the same results with the people I give consults away to than the people I charge? And generally not. But if you're careful about how you monitor it, if you really see the potential for true gratitude, that will give you results.
Yeah, one thing I found is that if I find some way for them to exchange with me,
yeah,
then
yeah. Yeah, and that's exactly it. It is an energy flow. It is an exchange. So it doesn't have to be money. Yes.
The other thing that's important here, when you talk about self communication, if you see someone on a weekly basis, my cells are telling yourself, I think you're important, and I want to see your face every day. And there are sometimes you could tell somebody to take a glass of water, and that would be medicine to them because you care enough, and the intention behind it is that you're valuable to me. And I think that's reciprocated in a practitioner relationship with another client. And I think that's really important to stress.
Very nice comment. And essentially the comment was that if you're seeing somebody weekly, your system or cells are reminding their system or cells that they're important. And it's what I was saying earlier, that there is a healing relationship going on here. And I would totally agree with that. And with herbalism, I can't really justify seeing somebody every week unless I've got an acute condition I'm treating. You know, and then there's been times when, or at least you do it by phone. I want to talk to you in 2 days. You know, how you doing? Or even overnight. What did I just say? Treat? We don't treat. I was just kidding. We manage. Yeah, for the purposes of the tape. So what are we going to do here? Is there any other issues in your body, your mind, your health that you want to discuss, Deirdre? Not here. Okay. With great respect, I take that. So these are the main areas I would look at. Another question I would want to know, though: any skin issues in your past?
Mm.
Inflammatory type stuff.
Rashes. I could get stressed out. My father.
Okay, so Deirdre gets stress rashes, itchy spots. And those of you who know a little Ayurveda, what's that do to? So common is it's due to pitta. Anybody else?
And the dryness is her vata.
And the dryness is her vata. So here's what I would say about that. Now, I haven't done pulses yet, but there's two possibilities. Could be just pure pitta, and it could be wind that's inflaming, that's blowing on the fire, vata pushing pitta, right? And the symptomology I'm hearing to me sounds like it's wind blowing on fire. But the way I would differentiate this, besides practicing for a long time and having a hunch, is the pulse. And so I would actually take the pulse here and do it that way. Now, in terms of physical exam, hello. Good choice, we'll probably use it. Okay, now, in terms of physical exam, what I would normally do now is I'd put Deirdre, PE, physical exam, what I would normally do is put Deirdre on a table, and I would palpate her abdomen. I would feel some of the glands, inner body, cervical glands predominantly. If I had other reasons, I might go fishing for other glands. I'd basically stimulate a couple points on her body, see if they were sore. In this case, I might do kidney points and might look at other meridians to see if they were sensitive or reactive. And then after I did that physical, and I'd actually auscultate. I'd listen to her heart, I'd listen to her lungs. And that's basically a precaution. I was a medic for a while on the streets, and you never know what you're going to turn up when you auscultate. And it's actually interesting as well, because you can pick up murmurs and that sort of thing, which may or may not be of utilitarian value to an herbalist, but at the same time, as a clinician, it's quite fascinating to be able to find that stuff. So abdominal palpation is one of the things I would do, and I would look for tenderness or soreness along the abdomen. And you'd be surprised at the percentage of people that have tender or sore abdomens. And depending on where it is, it's generally intestinal. And I'd say my practice is probably 70 to 80%. And people, even people that say my digestion's perfect, a little belching here and there, you palpate, and like they're going, oh yeah, that's a little tender. And so what you're doing oftentimes is finding pockets of inflammation. What I'll do, you leave them full, you have them take off their shoes generally, put them on a table, lay them down on a table, and then generally what I'll do is have them expose their abdomen. So you're going just below the navel up to about the rib cage. Now, depending on how hip the person is and whatnot, one of the things that I will generally do before I actually touch the abdomen is I'll run my hand very slowly just above the abdomen, probably about 1 inch above the abdomen. And what I tell the person is, what I'm going to do is I'm just going to feel for temperature change along the abdomen if they look like they're skeptical. If it's some Rasta child, I'm going to say, I'm feeling your energy field here. And I can tell you very honestly that after doing this for a while, on the days that I'm tuned in, I can't do it every day, but on the days that I'm tuned in, I can feel areas. Now, this may sound fantastic to some of you, but in fact, some of the research is suggesting that cells do sense electromagnetic fields. Okay, so what you're doing is you're sensing an electromagnetic field and shifts in that. What's that? Yeah, it's like therapeutic touch, exactly. And there is enough research at this point in time, number one, to show that a healer's hands can project an energy field 1,000 times stronger than our normal energy field, okay? And number two, that we have the potential to sense things. So that's how I start. Then I'd palpate the abdomen. I'd actually do a liver palpation as well. So what you're doing is you're using the side of your hand and you're going under the rib cage, right side and left side, okay? And you will feel or won't feel the liver, so you can tell if the liver is enlarged or if there's tenderness in there. I'll palpate spleen as well. I had an interesting experience with a nurse that had been in medicine for years. In fact, her husband, who was a PA, sent her to me. And so she had chronic fatigue. And I palpate her abdominal cavity, and I palpate her spleen area, and I say, you know, I think her spleen is enlarged, which is not uncommon in chronic fatigue. And being in the medical field, she came back for a follow-up, and she went, you know, we ran an ultrasound on my spleen. And I'm going, uh-oh. I hope I was right, right? And she goes, it's slightly enlarged. So you can really develop skills here. You can really develop skills over time.
Normally you should not.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, you should not be able to feel the spleen normally, but in this case, we could actually feel the spleen. So I would do that, And then what I would do is I would sit the patient up, and I do it in this order for a reason. I'd sit the patient up, and I'd have them sit with their legs hanging over the edge of the table. Okay, and so imagining Deirdre at a higher level so that I can actually stand in a more comfortable position, I said, I'd like to take your pulse. And yeah, what I'm going to do is I'm going to support your arm. So you completely make your, that's it, just make it into a wet noodle. And so I would take the pulse like this. Now the reason I palpate first, okay, because when you first approach somebody and you get close to them, you scare people. They don't know you, right? So what happens? The pulse changes, right? But if you do it this way, if you lay them down on the table and, you know, you're touching their body, right? They're getting over it, okay? Oh, somebody's touching me, right? And then they'll relax into it. And this process takes 7, 10, 15 minutes. So then when you finally sit them up, when you sit them up, they're going, oh, okay, I have a little more control now. I'm not the dog that's just exposing his juggler to the big dog, right? Because essentially there's a component of that's what's going on. I'm laying here vulnerable and some of my skin is exposed, right? That's a pretty scary thing. And you can also see how people lay there in terms of potential sexual abuse past, just by the way people tense up or hold their arms, you can start to see all this over time. So when they finally sit up, they're going to relax more. Oh, okay, I'm sitting up, a little more control, okay? And being close now isn't a problem because you've just palpated their abdomen. They still may be a little excited, especially if they do have a bit of a past, okay? But you can also feel that by the rate of the pulse. Okay? So let's actually do that. Zoe, are you okay if mm-hmm. I feel your pulse? And so the first thing I feel with Deirdre, no surprise, is that she's cold. Okay, this room is not particularly warm. And so what I'm doing here, now it depends on what system of pulse you use in Ayurveda. Some systems will tell you there's 7 different layers of pulse, literally layers from superficial all the way down to almost obstructing the pulse. And then within that system, there's different parts of the finger that give you information, so it gets incredibly complex. I don't use that. The reason I don't use it is because, you know what, I need to make a living and I can't take an hour to do a pulse diagnosis. So what I do is I use essentially 3 layers. I use a superficial, a middle, and a deeper layer, and sometimes I'll even just use 2 layers, depending on what's going on. And the same thing, guys, I've been feeling pulses for, we'll get to your pulse. I've been feeling pulses for probably since about 1987. And some days, man, I'm on it, you know? I can pick up information about people, emotional bodies, and I say something to them and they're like, how did you do that? Right? Other days, I'm not in my center, and I'm not getting a lot of information. Okay? So the pulse process itself is a meditative process. It is absolutely not a left brain process. Okay? It is definitely a meditative process. So you have to put yourself in the right frame of mind. Now, stop and think. Medicine in the right brain. Wait, isn't that an oxymoron? Right? Isn't medicine scientific? Well, yeah, but what is the definition of science? You know, we have physicists now that meditate because they've realized the limitations of their frontal cortex and they want to understand the universe on a different level. Okay? A lot of the scientific discoveries that have been made have come through dreams. Not very left-brained. Right? Discovery, what's that? Like Kathy's formula this morning. Acetylcholine, major neurotransmitter in the body, and its effects on the heart were discovered through a dream. Okay? This is not an uncommon experience that we have to change our level of consciousness, that we have to experience a different trance state than the trance state you're sitting in now or the trance state you might be in when you're thinking rationally about what does all this information mean together. Pulse is a different trance state. Okay. So, if you will permit me. Deirdre, you are a wonderful expression of wind. Right, let's do the other side. Now, traditionally, for an Ayurvedic pulse, well, first of all, there's probably a dozen different traditions of Ayurvedic medicine, and they all look different. Okay, there's some common threads through them in terms of the main principles of Ayurveda, but they all look different. So one system of taking pulse is, for a female, all you do is you read the left pulse. And for a male, all you do is read the right pulse. I use something that's a little closer to the Chinese model where I'm reading organ systems as well. So, and that's why I'm reading both sides here. Deirdre, I just want to say you're a lot stronger than you might feel sometimes. You're a warrior. Okay, she's got a remarkably strong heart pulse, although it's thin right now. It's remarkably strong. And what's also happening is Deirdre's energy right now is very turned in, and I would be too if I was sitting there. So her pulses are actually fairly difficult to read right now because she's contracted. And so this is one, and this is clinical work, right? You hear the old thing about, well, the time to take the pulse is when the patient wakes up. I don't do house calls, especially first thing in the morning. Okay, so you just have to learn to deal with the information you get. So here's what I'm feeling in general. I'm feeling a fairly windy pulse, in a fairly feeble pulse. So here's what I'm thinking in terms of a mental, emotional model. Is that, and this is obvious, I mean, you look at all the things that Deirdre's gone through, and there's a fair amount of fear and anxiety and nervousness right now in her life. And that shows up in the pulse. And once you really learn how to read the qualities, and this is a question that you asked earlier about, well, I'm not really sure I understand Vata and Pitta and Kapha. To really understand the pulse, you really need to, you know, my teacher used to say, if I call you at midnight, you must be able to tell me, what are the qualities of Vata? Yeah, well, that's true. You got to be able to do it without thinking. And when then you get that, you translate that information into that model, and you start going, oh, this is a depression pulse, or this is an anxiety pulse, or this is, we have some heat in the liver. You start realizing that. And obviously, that's studying the whole system. But that this is part of what we're feeling, is a tremendous amount of wind. You run down a little bit, and I get that from kidney pulse. And the reason I say what I do about the heart pulse, and you are a warrior. You're a warrior of the heart. You're willing to face things. And that comes from this heart pulse that is fairly, although thin, and might even be described as weak. And this is on an emotional level, not necessarily on a physical level. Your heart function's fine. Okay. But what we're feeling here is a pulse that has a strength in it as well. Besides being described here as the word I just used, weak, or perhaps not prominent is perhaps a better term. There's also a strength here where it's very hard to impede this pulse or obstruct this pulse. Okay. One of the things I've found in my own practice that, you know, I don't know, 1,000 patients maybe, I don't know what it is, but one of the things that I've found is that a heart pulse, deep first finger on the left-hand side that is easily obstructed is a propensity towards depression. Not to say that there hasn't been some depression here, but if it's not easily obstructed, this is usually somebody that's going to step up to the plate. Okay, not that depressed people can't step up to the plate, But it's the tone of the system is very difficult. I mean, the tone of the system starts affecting behavior. Yeah.
Can you elaborate on your definition of obstruction?
Yeah. When I say obstruction, you can actually stop the flow. Okay. And this is one of the very classic things you'll see in a pulse where vata's pushing pitta, or wind is blowing on fire. You'll touch the pulse and it'll be bounding, right? And you'll go, oh, this is pitta. And then you start playing with it a bit. And you obstruct it quite easily. That's not pitta. That's wind that's blowing on pitta. So think about what wind does to a forest fire, right? It inflames it. Okay, so that's what goes on in this case of vata pushing pitta. But I think the skin issue here that we talked about is actually more of a wind condition. Yes, there's inflammation involved, and yes, that has a pitta component to it, but this is a wind condition more than anything else. And the reason I did ask that question about skin is just looking at you, you look like you could be fairly reactive. Where do I get that? I get that from freckles. I get that from red hair. I get that from a system that I already know is central nervous system is reactive. Brownish red. Yeah. We have an ENS that's somewhat reactive. So this is how I'm thinking about this.
Along those lines, anger flare-ups. Could you say, I mean, that you think would be pitta, but if they often say anger is a, you know, there's
a shield for fear.
Right, so that could be vata blowing on, and that, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, and this is really, really common. One of the ways to distinguish pitta anger versus wind-flared anger is what happens when you go up to the person and you just give them a great big hug and you say, I'm so sorry. And the wind-flared anger will usually relax. Go, okay, I'm safe. Because okay? It's actually induced by fear. The fire-induced anger is like, "Arr, get away from me!" Yes, that's true. It's a risky diagnostic, right?
I would recommend that you not do that. I appreciate what you're trying to do. Not a good sign.
Right. That must be pitta. That's right. That's exactly right. How are we doing on time? Can somebody fill me in? I got 5 minutes. Okay, let's wrap this up and see where we'd go with this. Okay, so herbs. Well, actually, first let's start with lifestyle, because this is a key point. Now, one of the main treatments for vata is routine. Okay, so what do we have here? We have a situation where we've got how many jobs? Five?
Yeah.
About five jobs. And they change, right? Okay. So one of the, now this sounds so simple, but I'm telling you it has a profound effect. So we need routine in the life, and I'm going to kind of hustle through this because I want to finish. But we've got to have some sort of routine in the life. So what I would say to you is find a sleep pattern in terms of bedtime and wake up time that suits you and that work in the life right now, and stick to it. Okay. I'd also say if you can schedule more routinely, in other words, more guarantee the schedule that you're on in your life in terms of the work schedule and even seeing your boyfriend type of thing, that's going to be really good for you. And you have to think about it as, not that we're calling you a small child, but think of the vata as a small child. Treat vata like a flower. These are delicate, sensitive people. And how would you treat a child? Would you say, I'm not really sure when we're going to have breakfast today, okay, but we'll get it sometime, I think, right? And that's what vatas tend to do to themselves. You can't possibly treat an organism like that and expect a good response, okay? So that's a key piece here. So we need routine. The other thing comes back to dietary. And what I'm going to say is What I would do here is I'd work with protein-carbo ratio. And what I'd say to you is, in fact, I think you heard this already, so I'm going to do it quickly, but we're going to split the day into half, okay? 5 p.m. is our dividing line. And what we're doing is attempting to match her circadian rhythm. So what we're going to say to Deirdre is we're going to say, anything before 5 p.m., I want you to lean on the protein side. Doesn't mean you can't eat carbos, but you're leaning on the protein side. And if you snack, should probably be protein or nuts, something like that, not carbos, okay? Anything after 5 p.m., what we're going to do is we're going to lean on the carbohydrate side. Doesn't mean we can't eat any protein. So let's say you're having a meal of fish and rice, or even, let's make it easier, vegetarian. You're having a meal of tofu and rice. Before 5 p.m., lots of tofu, smaller serving of rice. After 5 p.m., smaller serving of tofu, larger serving of rice. Leafy greens, vegetables that aren't starch vegetables don't count. In other words, eat as many of them as you can. Okay? But for you, this is in general, but for you, what we want to do is we want to lean on warm foods. So soups would be a really good thing. Throwing everything into one pot. You start the digestion for them. Okay? You throw everything into one pot, and you start that digestive process for them. So soups would be a really nice, warming, nurturing food here. But what I would say to you is consider following your boyfriend around in the morning in terms of watching what he's eating. Okay, if he's eating protein in the morning. Okay? The typical American diet does exactly the opposite thing as I just described. Okay, which changes your circadian rhythm. Carbos in the evening will set you up for better neurotransmitter production. Protein in the morning will set you up so you're not insulin spiking, which affects mood in a drastic way and really affects anxiety and also affects adrenaline secretions. Okay, herb-wise, what I'm going to suggest for you is I'm going to suggest two formulas. Okay, one is a powder. And here's what I'm thinking. I'm thinking that I didn't do an abdominal palpation. I'm thinking I'm going to find some soreness if I do, just from the description of what I've heard. And so what I want to do is I want to work with the membranes. Okay. Now, quite frankly, I don't have enough information to formulate the way I'd like to. So this is off the cuff. But what I'm going to do is, what herb do you think I'm going to give them? A pen of powder. Those of you Ayurvedic heads in here. Triphala, right. So I'm going to use triphala, but I'm not just going to use triphala alone. I'm going to use triphala with a little bit of licorice. And the licorice will not only stabilize blood sugar levels potentially for this person, it also tends to be anti-inflammatory, right? And it also will start to address some of the dryness in the system, because licorice will help you hold on to your fluids. Also, in terms of the stress hormones, it's going to have a positive effect on the hormones. So I'd probably do something like this. You like cinnamon?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, probably what I'd do here is, now a lot of people don't formulate with triphala, but I do. I'm probably going to do something like this, and a dose of somewhere, now I don't know because I don't have enough information, but I might use somewhere from one teaspoon OD to BID. So formula being triphala 30 grams, glyceriza 15 grams, cinnamomum or cinnamon 5 grams, gingiber or ginger 5 grams, and my suggested dose is probably going to be a teaspoon once to twice a day. That would be before breakfast and at bedtime. Okay. Without food. Well, before breakfast, so empty stomach, and then at the end of the day. Now this brings up a really good question. If you said that to a client/patient, they would say, "Oh, you know, I had a snack late at night, so I didn't take my formula." No worries. Take the formula. Okay. So that's one of the things I'm going to do. The other thing I'm going to do here with Deirdre is I'm going to think about a nighttime formula for her. And I'm thinking about roots. So what I'm going to use with her is I'm going to use withania, which is ashwagandha. I'm going to use piper-methysticum, and I'm going to use glyceriza again. And I would actually like to do this as a tea. You ask the patient if she's got that much patience, she can make a tea. I might use it as a tincture. Okay. So those are the formulas that I'd actually use here. Piper-methysticum is kava. Yeah. It's a root, right? So we're using roots here to stabilize you. And what I've found in terms of ashwagandha as a tea is that it tends to be nicely sedating at night. Great sleep. Drink a cup of ashwagandha tea before bed, you will sleep like a baby. Okay? What we're doing is adding a little piper methysticum to change the tone of the central nervous system, which actually the ashwagandha is going to do as well. This is also adaptogenic. So what we've just done is modified her stress response, the anxiety during the day, that sort of thing. The licorice just brings the formula together, a little bit of licorice in this. Okay. So that's, in a nutshell, what I'm going to do here with this.